Now, last time I tried to make clear that the middle classes, inheriting the mantle of the aristocracy and the court in most of Europe, and even where they did not inherit this, certainly becoming, even in Germany, the civil service, and certainly the lawyers, the guardians of the constitution, as it were, engaged in a process of elite building. But this process of elite building through education also had another and perhaps even more important side to it, that in liberalism, as I tried to explain it to you, with these two pillars, one pillar being constitutional government and the other pillar being the idea of respectability, of manners and morals, education was really the bridge in between them. Education is what enabled you in the end to have the kind of public spirit which would involve you in government, in constitutional government, in the making of the laws, which would integrate you as a citizen. Now, the idea of Bildung in Germany, which I discussed last time with a brief side view to France, was based on the Enlightenment. But nevertheless, von Humboldt's idea also had a great deal of pietism in it, if indirectly. That is to say, classical learning was at the center, but there was also some emphasis on good behavior, on respectabilities, implied, but implied rather than offered. In England, of course, it is quite different. In England, the system of education is different, and the evangelical basis of that education in the 19th century is different. Now, to be sure, in Germany as well, the high schools or gymnasia were mostly not coeducational, and neither were the fraternities at the universities. So that Germans also moved in what you might call a male society, and that there also arose an old boys network, which is really what the ruling elite is, as I tried to tell you last time. A kind of male society. And in Germany also, to a certain extent, the kind of male friendships you made in the gymnasium would last you through life. You would probably go to the same fraternity, and you would probably then go together in the civil service and protect each other, protectia, as we call it in Israel, which works on that principle. So would protect each other and further each other through this kind of old boy network. But in England, of course, this was, as it were, heightened by the fact that the education of the elite in England was a boarding school education. And that, unlike Germany, you were taken away from home, put in an environment which Thomas Arnold, about whom you are reading, Thomas Arnold, the reformer of Rugby, the school to which Tom Brown went, headmaster of Tom Brown, which Thomas Arnold called a microcosm of the state. So that from the age of 10, you in fact lived in a society divorced from home, family, and the outside world, which was a microcosm of the state. And, as you will see, of a more or less self-governing state. Therefore, here, of course, you have a much more coherent elite. The friendship you made in the great public schools, and remember, in England, public schools means private boarding schools. The friendships you made at Eton or Harrow, or even at Rugby, would last you through Cambridge or Oxford, because you would go to the same college. Whatever college you went to from Rugby, I'm not sure now, you would go to the same college. From my school, you went to Emmanuel, because my school was a Quaker school. Emmanuel was the Quaker college. You went to Emmanuel, and these friendships would last, because then you would go into the civil service together, you would go to Parliament together, and one hand would wash another. the old boys network would remain intact, but it works in literature and art just the same way. The English elite, therefore, was singularly coherent. Let me give you just some figures to make it clear to you. Between 1918 and 1935, as late as that, 43% of all members of parliament came from public schools, usually from three or four of the most famous public schools. But I would say until 1918, it was probably more than 60% of members of parliament came from this kind of elite. Even in the Labour government of Clement Attlee after the Second World War, 11 out of 34 members of the cabinet came from public schools, mostly from one public school, from Winchester, because they were all friends in Winchester, they all went to the Labour Party from Winchester, and they all governed England eventually. So it's a very cohesive elite. And the first English Prime Minister who had not gone to a public school was Harold Wilson in the 1960s. He was simply a grammar school boy. But before that, they were all public schools. Indeed, they were by and large Etonians. Between 1945 and 1950, for example, one-tenth of all cabinet members were Etonians. And the dominance of Eton over the English political process was even more considerable before. The kind of public school that you read about in Tom Brown, which is Rugby, is a rather new public school. Rugby is a middle-class public school. Eton, Harrow, and Winchester are old foundations dating back to the Middle Ages, and they had a mixture of aristocracy and middle class, while Tom Brown's school was really more or less a new kind of middle class foundation. But in the end, it made very little difference whether it is Winchester, Eton, or Harrow, or Rugby, which you are reading about. It is a most coherent elite. Now, the public schools date back to the Middle Ages. It's not new. Eton, Harrow, Winchester, all of those go back to the Middle Ages. But until about the middle of the 18th century, they had been what was called, quite rightly, nurseries of vice. That is to say, they had been completely chaotic. The students had done more or less what they wanted. There was hardly any discipline. They were a kind of farming ground for the sons and daughters of the aristocracy who kept hounds and hunted and kept their own servants at school from the age of 10. And there was, in other words, no discipline at all. That is, until you have the reform of the public schools, which goes hand in hand with the new manners and morals, with the onslaught of respectability, with the victory of the middle classes. And that reform of public schools was begun at Rugby, on Tom Brown's school. And it was begun by Tom Brown's headmaster, the famous Thomas Arnold. And from Thomas Arnold's work, it spread throughout the entire public school system, coming perhaps a little later to Eton and Harrow, which still had this aristocracy about it, than to Rugby or other schools of this nature. Now, the theory that lay behind the reforms is easy to explain, because it is the theory of the evangelical revival. The schools must make Christian gentlemen, not like the German Bildung in Greece, but Christian gentlemen. What lay behind it, I can best summarize by the most famous passage from a sermon. The center of the school, what was the center of the school now? The center of the school was the chapel. Because the center was exhortation to build your character. The chapel, even at the Quaker school I went to, we went to meeting twice a day. Yes? Now it has declined as everything. Which didn't mean there wasn't discipline. Character was built by exhortation, by, as you will see in a minute, learning how to command and obey by being a prefect and a fag. I'll explain to you in a minute what that is. Learning command and obey and by the rod. All three things were used to, I think, excellent effect. Now, what you have here, therefore, is the exhortation. Let me read you from one of Thomas Arnold's most famous sermons given somewhere in the 1830s. To the boys who ranged from 10 to 18. You weren't admitted to Cambridge or Oxford till the age of 18, from 10 to 18. I myself came only there at 21 because I flunked Cambridge entrance. But even in my day, which was in 1938, there was still aristocracy. You took 7 examinations for Cambridge entrance, 7 exams, and you could flunk them 7 times, which I did. And then you were admitted. So I could immediately discard natural science, which I never had in my life, and the irregular verb, and still get to a good college. But that has all changed with democratization, of course. So what you have, therefore, here is clear. Let me read you from that kind of sermon. Our hope, he told those boys, our hope that viciousness is not unavoidable depends upon you, whether or no you choose to make it so. Outward order, regularity, nay, even the advancement of learning, may up to a certain point be enforced. But no man can force another to be good or hinder him from being evil. It must be your own choice and act, whether indeed you wish this place, Rugby, Tom Brown School, to be unavoidably a seat or nursery of vice, or whether you wish to verify the words of our daily thanksgiving, that by the benefit of our founders, you are here brought up to godliness and good learning. And that is the famous phrase. Godliness and good learning was to be substituted for vice. Godliness and good learning was to be the slogan of Thomas Arnold's famous reform. Almost all teaching at these public schools then concerned behavior. How to live a righteous life. How to combat sin. And unlike Germany, there was not much emphasis on learning itself. It was all character formation and very little emphasis on learning. I can illustrate to you that again by taking, if I might, the most famous of public school novels. The most famous of public school novels, which, as it were, is only second in fame to Tom Brown's School Days, indeed more famous than Tom Brown's School Days, namely Frederick W. Farrar's Eric, or Little by Little, written on 1858, read by every English schoolboy, I assure you, up to the Second World War. Thomas Farrar's Eric, or Little by Little. Now, why little by little? Because Eric, little by little, sinks into sin. That's why, little by little. The novel is a hectic tale, that is true, how Eric, so beautiful, so strong, so manly, goes to a school and falls little by little into the great mire of sin. The mire of sin through which he falls, through bad associations, association with bullies. Remember the role of the bully in Tom Brown's School Days. The sins he falls into are 3, drinking, gambling, and masturbation, the 3 great sins of the public school. Because now we have the wonderful visual thing of the headmaster of Wellington, another great public school, spending his evenings patrolling the dormitories to see that one little boy doesn't do naughty things with another, and so on. And indeed, it was one of the great advices about masturbation, which I've talked to you before, that boys must never be alone with one another. And so these boarding schools were scenes of hectic activities, so that you were never alone, because as you will see, this is before games and sport played any part, whatever. So Eric then falls into sin, drinking, gambling, masturbation. But he has a friend, and that friend is an evangelical. He cites the Bible to him. And eventually, by the citing of the Bible to him, Eric is converted. Converted back, but oh, it is too late. He atones by saving a fellow student from drowning, but drowns himself. Vice has to be punished. You cannot let Eric scot-free after he has masturbated and drunk and gambled, that is clear. So he drowns in the end, but he drowns in a way atoning for his sins. Now, Ferrer's Eric, little by little, is the great Victorian lesson. Boyish sins may seem small, but they are not. Small sin leads to greater sin, until a lad by degrees is crushed in that great net of ever-increasing sinfulness. Now, this idea, which was still in my generation obvious, I was always told that if I did something that was forbidden, in the end I would end up a criminal and things like that. And I remind you of something else I read to you a long time ago, the children's book called The Fairchild Family of 1818, which is the same kind of thing. There, for children of about 12, it is written. Remember, I read it to you once. And everything the Fairchild children do, remember, is related to a biblical verse. So they steal an apple. The Fairchild children steal an apple. And they are punished cruelly by spanking, but cruel spanking. But worse still, the two little Fairchild sisters quarrel, and they're taken out to spend all night under a gibbet where two executed murderers are hanging, yes, and rotting. And they are told, if you go on quarreling, you'll end like these murderers, and then there's something from the Psalms which ends that passage. In other words, this was quite common. That together with the enforcement of that respectability, you had a kind of cruelty of punishment. Whether it was this book that I read you, The Fairchild Family of 1818, where these two little girls of 12, they were, for quarreling with each other, had to spend a night under a gibbet, and then this has biblical justification, or whether it is Eric, little by little, which ends by a drowning. The lesson is clear. Little sins lead to larger sins and eventually to perdition. Now, this then is the theory. It is common and garden evangelical theory, as you know from what we've talked about and we've discussed about before that. So there is about this really nothing very new about it. For if evangelism went into the emotionalism of romanticism, it also was based on self-discipline. Remember, the sins of the flesh, the reaction against the French Revolution, the reaction against the loose life of the aristocracy, and the middle-class way of life. Self-control, self-discipline. Responsibility. The school was, as I said before, to be the state as it ought to be, as Arnold calls it, a microcosm of the state. A microcosm of the state as it ought to be, the state as it should be. Now, this meant sin, and I want to read you another passage about another novel, just to drive it home for you, another very important novel about English school life, a little later, so you see it hasn't changed, 1810. This, and I'm reading you from the advertisement, this is the harrowing story of an Eton boy, 1910, of an Eton boy, son of a colonel in the army, a brilliant lad, always at the head of his class, who had been reduced to driveling imbecility as the result of secret sin, masturbation, induced by the sight of an obscene photograph exhibited by a scoundrel whom he met in a railway train. Here you have it all together, you see. You have the new age of photography, which made obscenity impossible to control, and you have the metaphor of the railway train, the new speed of time, which frayed the nerves. He's a degenerate, obviously. I had the satisfaction of hunting this villain down and procuring him a long service of penal servitude. Probably, too, the man who showed this obscene picture to this Eton boy in a railway train. So in all of this, now typically enough, with this kind of education, where the chapel was in the center, the priority was not on learning. Let us look at Arnold himself. What does Arnold say, again in chapel, about priorities? And what I have often said before, I repeat now. What we must look for here is, first, religious and moral principles. Second, gentlemanly conduct. And thirdly, intellectual ability. Intellectual ability is very much a third to religious and moral principle, which are first, and gentlemanly conduct, which is second. But of course, they are bound up in this concept of a Christian, a gentleman, the conduct and the morality based upon it. In the last resort, this kind of self-discipline and this kind of moral was not only exhorted in the chapel, enforced by the organization of the school to which I will come, but also by what we might call the gospel of work. The essence is not only the Bible, the morality which is cited. The essence is always the gospel of work, much more than in Germany, much more in Germany, where the middle class, after all, became civil servant and not properly ruling the empire or anything else, and there the emphasis was on discipline. But in England, the emphasis wasn't only on discipline. It was also on work for the future, if you like, ruling classes in this regard. That is another difference. And that emphasis on what we call the gospel of work is strong. Listen to Arthur Hugh Clough, the poet, a graduate of Rugby, like Tom Brown, about the same time that Tom Brown went to school. All things, writes Arthur Hugh Clough, became clear to me by work, more than by anything else. Any kind of drudgery will help one out of the most uncommon, either sentimental or speculative, perplexity. The attitude of work is the only one which can see things properly. Now, work, therefore, was, if you want to put it, another way to alienate, to end alienation in industrial society. To end alienation, work. Now, Arthur Hugh Clough committed suicide. Because it must be clear to you that these kind of schools, this kind of microcosm of the state, and I'll go in further, was not for sensitive souls. That if you were a poet, you were broken. And why, I'll come to in a minute. But this fact that Arthur Hugh Clough himself, before his suicide, puts it very well, this gospel of work, this sublimation from the ideal or from alienation, the sublimation from all of this. Now, as far as I've gone now with the moral side, I want to sum it up for you before I go on to the actual organization of the school itself, which is important for our purposes, by reading you by William Farrar, the man who wrote Eric and Little by Little, his description of an ideal English schoolboy. And as I read it, you can make comparison to your own high school and yourselves. He wrote this in the 1840s, and it sums it up. The ideal type, if you like, the ideal type which this education was supposed to produce. I conjure up the picture of a happy and healthy schoolboy, of a bright and open countenance with eager, well-opened eyes, clear-cut features, and fine waving hair. I shall come back to the importance of outward appearance. That is clear that we are here in a kind of mixture again, where outward appearance is as important, or an outward sign of inward grace, as it were. Of a bright and open countenance with eager, well-opened eyes, clean-cut features, and fine waving hair. Playful, yet tremendously in earnest. In earnest. That's the clue. In earnest. Joining heartily in games. Fond of bathing and swimming, but fondest of long rambles and scrambles among the cliffs and over the mountains. With his ear attuned to the voice of nature. Remarkably well read for a schoolboy, and with his memory stored with treasures gathered from the best of English poets. A good scholar who had laid already the foundation for that habit of unflinching industry, which was the chief secret of his success in life. Notice, you're not a scholar for learning. You're a scholar because it teaches industry. You're a scholar because it produces the gospel of work, not for learning at all. The chief secret of his life, a boy whose moral influence was always strenuously exerted on the side of all that is manly and honest. Beyond all, a boy of stainless and virginal purity, who took for his motto the text from the Bible, of course, keep innocency, and do the thing that is right, for that shall bring a man peace at his last. Now that is the ideal English schoolboy by the author of Eric Little by Little, and that will give you some idea of the ideal type. It meant a moral earnestness. It meant responsibility. As Kingsley said, sanitary work is a religious duty. And it meant, after all, an emphasis on discipline. What liberalism seemed to deny so much, overtly, with its idea of laissez-faire and competition, it took back here in the idea of discipline, self-discipline, the gospel of work, character, purity, respectability. All of these things are clear. It is still made more clear, I think, by the organization of the school itself. The organization of the school itself through what we would call the corporate administration of the school by the students, by the schoolboys. And this was an invention of Thomas Arnold, which spread to all schools and to American colleges as well, to a certain extent. Namely, that you should learn to command and obey, so that the school was run by the highest form, the sixth form, the seniors, as you would say, ran the school. They administered all discipline. They were in charge of all the other boys. They had the right to spank, they had the right to punish, they were in charge of discipline. And the lowest form, the ones who entered the school, were what is called the fags. They were given as servants, in fact, to the seniors of the school. What did that mean as servants? They made their tea. They made their afternoon tea. We're in England now. They made their beds. They ran their errands. They had to be at their beck and call. But eventually, of course, they themselves would have youngsters at their beck and call. This is the famous system of fagging. You fagged, for a senior, and you learn, therefore, to obey and to command. That depends what sort of a senior you had, what sort of a fag master you had, yes? You know, whether he was strict or not. I can assure you, when I was a fag master, there was nothing to laugh about. So, anyway, a combination, you know, of the English public school and the Prussian upbringing. So, whatever happened is clear. You were at the beck and call. You can't imagine that. But it was a way of making the school into a corporate entity. And still, when I went to the American Quaker College, I went to Haverford College in the war, just before the war, the freshmen still had these funny hats. And every freshman, even at the college, I don't know whether that's still so today, when a senior stopped him and asked him to do an errand, had to do the errand. Had to do the errand. I don't know whether that's true today. It's never been true at the University of Wisconsin, of course, unfortunately. Because I think it was very good training to learn how to command and obey, yes? Because, in a sense, you were trained to be the ruling class. And even if my training never fitted me for something I was never going to be, not through my fault. I'd love to have been a ruler of empires. Lovely. But there's no longer an empire to rule, just to visit, unfortunately. Anyhow, it was an excellent training. Because it is, after all, what made the English civil service so great and the proconsuls of the empire such people of integrity. Because you did learn a kind of integrity through all of this, that again fits into the kind of public spirit. Because already as an 18-year-old, you were responsible, as it were, for a state, for a microcosm, as it were. You already were running a state as an 18-year-old and keeping the rest of the students in order, which meant, of course, all sorts of functions. My particular function, I'll tell you, was lovely. I had a function to inspect fingernails going into dinner, you see, which means I didn't have to clean my own and just inspect everybody else's. Fine. And punish them, you see. I had to see that the beds were made just right. And if they didn't make the beds just right, winter or summer, I sent them to take 10 runs around the building in their nightgowns in snow and things like that. There's still people who won't talk to me this day. I forgot for this discipline. But this was done to me too, you understand. It was done to me too, yes? It was done to me too. And it was the way these schools were organized and still are to a great extent, I can't tell you for today, organized the system of fagging and the system of responsibility. The result was that one thing you never did, and that's in Tom Brown, very strong. All this explains to you what you're reading. It's very strong in Tom Brown. You never told on a teacher. The teachers weren't at all involved in discipline. You never told. You never ratted, as we say, on your fellow students. Whatever they did, you punished. You told the sixth form, and the sixth formers would punish. But you never told a teacher. And the only time a headmaster would punish is for some really serious infringement in which a teacher had caught you, in which a teacher had caught you. But you learned not to tell. In other words, you learned loyalty. You would say class loyalty, corporate loyalty. You learned. Because if you told, you were expelled from the school. In other words, you could go to the headmaster and say, little so-and-so has bullied so-and-so, as in Tom Brown. You would denounce that bully, yes, from Tom Brown. The headmaster would expel you. He wouldn't punish the bully. He would punish you. Because the idea, again, is this elite building, this corporate loyalty, this very definite loyalty. Now, that was a lesson confined to England. And, of course, a country with an empire, it was necessary. But you didn't have that in Germany. There was none at all of that corporate loyalty because the system was just so quite different. The character has to be built. Now it is clear also, I think, here that this new elite This new elite had its great weaknesses. Through character foundation, science had almost no part in the curriculum, and that is directly related to England's present decline and to the backwardness of English technology. Directly related. Neither did it in Oxford or Cambridge, in the colleges. That wasn't what you went into. Science didn't have much part. I never had any science at all, because on a science master in school in England and in Germany, I became the champion of the school in roasting chestnuts over Bunsen burners. But that didn't teach me very much about science. And to this day, I really don't know how things work at all. I have no idea about science. I never had any science. And I'm an example you can live a happy life without. So anyway, but when it comes to rule a country, it's something quite different. And this kind of denigration of science has a direct bearing of the decline of Britain, a direct bearing on that, very direct. And of course, in a way, in Tom Brown, you can see it too, that the attitude towards the outside world is the attitude towards fags, yes, towards children. You have that, of course, wonderfully said in Rudyard Kipling's most famous poem about the British Empire, a poem any English schoolboy would know to this day, Gunga Din. Gunga Din is a native, but Gunga Din is a child. So in other words, Kipling's famous view of the Indian, not a racist view, I would say, at all, but a view as a child, a view as a fag, who must be, as it were, treated like a fag and who would then perhaps graduate higher up. But the natives were fags. They were children, really, and treated, as it were, as children. Children of God, but still children. Governing didn't mean oppression. There's nothing more absurd than this applying of racism to the British Empire, the way the British Empire was governed, totally misunderstanding of racism, misunderstanding of this. Some people use racism today as if all oppression is racism. Words are devaluated. It's absurd and ridiculous. And when you really meet it, you won't recognize it anymore because it's devaluated as a word. So that's not at all true. It wasn't really a matter of oppression. It was a matter of guidance. There's a difference there. And of responsibility and of guidance. Not a matter of oppression, really. The natives were fags, but unlike Tom Brown, eternal fags, in a sense, yes? But there is implied here an attitude towards children. This elite, and this is another weakness of it, was, of course, isolated. The only way you met the working class was as biddies. Oh, you don't know what biddies were, Oxford and Cambridge, yes. In the Oxford and Cambridge colleges, in my day at any rate, I don't know how it's changed, you had servants, of course, didn't make your own beds or anything. You had servants, and these women who served you were chosen for their ugly looks, for obvious reasons, yes? They were called biddies in my days. And that's the only lower class people you ever met, were the biddies, because they came in the morning and laid the fire before breakfast. Remember, there was no central heating in those days. Laid the fire before breakfast, they cooked your breakfast, they cooked anything else you want. Of course, you had a servant in my day in Oxford or Cambridge, But that's how you met the working classes, in a way, as servants. So you were pretty isolated. You were pretty isolated from the social realities, yes? You were pretty isolated from the lower classes. So then I come back again that this elite is a middle-class elite which takes in the aristocracy. Rugby wasn't so mixed. My own school wasn't mixed much either, but Eton and Harrow and the big public school would be mixed between aristocracy and middle-class people were mixed, yes? Now, with all of this, there is a final concept which becomes important and which I have not dealt with, except it appeared in one of the quotations I read you. And that is the concept of manliness. Thomas Hughes, who wrote Tom Brown's Schoolboys, wrote another famous book from which I will read you on Friday called The Manliness of Christ. In other words, all this was connected with a certain idea, an idea of manliness, which you have not only in England, perhaps strongest there, but also in Germany. The idea of the Christian gentleman, the idea of manliness. And this education is, of course, you understand, another step in what I call the de-emancipation of women in the 19th century, which must be so clear. Women imitated men's schools. You get in England, even women's, there are women's public school, but the houses in women's public school have men's names more often than not. And the school uniform of English girls in public school is the same as in English boys. I forgot to say that, of course, you have a school uniform, which detaches you still more from the outside world. You have a school uniform. This still all exists, as we would say in German, in Rheinkultur. This all exists, this all still exists, of course, without any change in South Africa and Australia. The highlight of my visit to Australia was when I gave a talk to the Church of England, to the Canberra Church of England girls' schools. And there were these girls from the age of 10 to 18, all in their school uniforms, which I used to think purposely made them look ugly, which they do. But I think that isn't the matter. They're an imitation of the boys' uniform. And I gave them a lecture on sex on campus. Boy, I wasn't asked back to that. Anyhow, I thought that would be good for them. Anyhow, probably was. It still exists. It still exists, this sort of thing, in the former British Empire. And when I looked out of last year, when I looked out of my window in Cape Town in the morning, I saw all these boys and girls going to their school, all in their nice uniform, as I used to have my uniform, the cap and the uniform, and everything of this nature, obviously. Now, what about the cult of manliness to which we must come? It begins really after Arnold's days. And it begins really with the exaltation of sports in schools. Now, Arnold had despised sports. For Arnold, the basic discipline was work, not sport. Yes? But with the growth of sports in the early 19th century onward, sport becomes almost takes the place of work as the school of discipline. Discipline in an interesting way, which is totally foreign to Americans. Namely, again, corporate discipline. For what? The sport is team sport, and more than that, when you watched games at school, you cheered for the game and not for the side. That is to say, the only football, American football I ever watched, I was taken, and it was explained to me. I didn't understand it very well, still don't. It's not worth it, I think. But anyway, I don't understand it, but what shocked me terribly is that people cheer for one side. And that's one of the worst aspects of American life, this competitiveness. Now, in school sports, of course, as they grew up in this evangelical movement, you cheered the game and not the side. Regardless if the other side made a good move, you cheered it. You were interested in the game and not the side. And that was very important because it reinforced this corporate ideal. And I must say, I remember how shocked I was. And then I met the coach, a very famous coach, and asked me what I thought. And I thought for $4 entrance, they should paint the ball red so I didn't have to strain to see it. I thought this was the most sensible suggestion I made. I must tell you this, I don't know why, I also upset a neighboring university by getting through the faculty a motion that they abolish football and hire what was then the best football team, the Chicago Bears, as artists in residence. I thought that was more honest. I still think that is much more honest than this sham here of having these football camps and these football players whom you really have as gladiators, but not really as scholars. So I used to be very enthusiastic in these crusades. I got it through the faculty, and I still see the president who presided went pale, of course. Yes? And I then left, and when I came to Madison, I must tell you that, I was there, and suddenly a stranger came up and said, I hope we'll be good friends, when I first came to Madison. And that was the football coach of the University of Wisconsin. He was afraid of me. Huh? So anyway, I've always wanted to be on the athletic board, but when my friend Fred Harrington was president, he said, I can't put you on the board because you'd abolish it, and I would too. So anyway, anyhow, the point that I want to make isn't really this. The point I want to make is that sports became a passion, but a passion not in the competitive way. Yes, I was very popular in school, but what happened to me in soccer was always I forgot where the goal was, so I often kicked a goal in my own side. To this day, I don't know, you're in the middle of the field. How do you know it's there and there? I never know. You know? So boom, I kicked my own side. Made no difference. Good goal, good game. You see? That's how you have to do it. And I must say again, you see, the very fact that you can't grasp it is this terrible idea of American competitiveness. We must be better than the others. We must have bigger bombs and bigger this and bigger that. And it's never play and play the game. That's after all the English slogan after Thomas Arnold. Play the game. It isn't win. It's play the game. Play, play, and play the game, which you shout from the sidelines. You don't shout to win. So that this idea of the sports, the exaltation of sports, was, of course, again connected also with the anti-intellectualism, which is involved in all of this. There was nothing worse than to be a brilliant boy in one of these schools. You were a sweat. You were, of course, you were bullied, obviously. That's also something of this in Tom Brown. You were bullied. Now, let me say one final thing today before I come to manliness on Friday. I want to say this, that when you read Tom Brown now, I think perhaps you have a better idea what you are reading and what the thrust is and what the organization of the school was in which Tom Brown is, after all, the ideal schoolboy, the ideal schoolboy and the idealization of rugby. Well, we'll continue next time.